Hello and welcome to the Tech and Trees podcast. My name is Pascal Mies, and on Tech and Trees, I talk to climate tech founders, operators, investors, and academics who get me smarter on how to build better climate tech companies. Having spent the past year on the African continent, I am now in the final stages of this series of African guests. This time, I'm talking to the economics professor and economic historian Johan Fourie. He's something like the South African Noah Yuval Harari, whom you might know for his book Sapiens: A Short History of Mankind. Johan wrote a book as well called Our Long Walk to Economic Freedom. In this book, he tells the history of human development, the role that economics play for progress, and most importantly, he tells this whole story from a South African perspective. We talk about the importance of innovation and entrepreneurship for development, and I get his take as an economist on climate change and AI. I think from time to time it's good to just, you know, get an overview, see the world through an academic's eyes and not through the founders who are on the ground operating. So sit back and enjoy.
Welcome to Tech and Trees.
Johan, thank you so much for taking the time. Lovely of you to take the time and be here with me today. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Yeah, it's winter in South Africa, but we've had a week or so of good weather, so I'm in a good mood, I guess.
In a jolly mood. That's good. That's good. I like that. My first question for you today is actually, how would you answer the question, Johan Fourie? Well, how would you finish the sentence? Actually, it's not a question. How would you finish the sentence, Johan Fourie is?
Yeah, I guess Johan Fourie is an economic historian that teaches at Stellenbosch University. That's how I would typically, you know, the bio would typically start. And depending on the audience, I might just stop there. But if it's an audience that I would want to know a little bit more, then I would say either, you know, go into the kind of more academic credentials, or I would probably prefer to say that I'm an author of a book about kind of global economic history that's written from a South African perspective. And I would also say probably that I'm a blogger and a columnist. So I enjoy writing, and I enjoy kind of a wide variety of topics and reading about them and then sharing them with my readers. That's, I guess, in a nutshell, how I would define myself.
Yeah, awesome. And I mean, yes, on your blog, for example, you address a really wide variety of topics, but you always manage to like sneak a little economics perspective in there. So I'd like to know from you, what is an economic wisdom or principle that everyone should know?
Yeah, that is a difficult question. I'm going to cite Paul Krugman, actually, who's a trade economist, won a Nobel Prize. Who basically, he said, you know, most of the things, radical ideas that people might have are actually just ideas that you will find in a first year economics textbook. I think economics has received a bad rap often. There are good reasons to be critical of economists, of course. And I've been myself as an economic historian. I value context, and I think often the models we have aren't context specific enough. But I also think that economics is an incredibly powerful science, and the ideas that we've developed over more than a century can be incredibly useful and usefully applied to countries to build more prosperous societies. And often those ideas are not profound, but they're not super complicated. Economists might be bad at communicating them, but sometimes just basic neoclassical or classical economics might be good enough to address some of the most serious issues that faces us.
I'm interested then, if you say that economists are bad at communicating potentially, what's the last aha moment you've had? The last moment you started.
So I've been writing a post, two posts actually over the last 2 days, about one about Greece. So I recently traveled to Greece. It was my first time there, and I really enjoyed it as a kind of an an eye-opening into a society that has really faced tremendous challenges over the last decade. And I actually hadn't thought very hard about these, what had happened in Greece before going there, and actually not even, you know, during while I was there, but I became aware of it while I was there, and then obviously did some reading afterwards. And then just realized, I mean, I don't think, you know, most South Africans certainly, but I think even most people realized, you know, just how much the shock of the post-global financial crisis, or the Greek debt crisis, affected the ordinary Greek citizen, right? When you've got a GDP that collapses by a quarter, that's massive. So often, I think when I was a student still at Stellenbosch here, we had a very old development economist professor who would say, you know, you can't be a development economist if you're not in the field, if you're not out there in the community, or, you know. And this was a perfectly good example of that, right? It's traveling to Greece that I actually only understood what numbers really couldn't tell me. And it would be afterwards that I would understand, you know, after reading some of what had happened and some other kind of, you know, what others have written about the lessons. I actually haven't found a wonderful summary of the lessons learned, right? We have great summaries of what had happened and to some extent, you know, what were the policies that were proposed at the time. But, you know, now looking back more than a decade, then I still don't think we know exactly what are the lessons for economics or economic history even that we've learned. So that was the one aha moment. And the other one, the next post is about genetics. So this is also something that, and specifically about DNA analysis and what we can reveal, not about our future, obviously the kind of likelihood of disease and these kind of things that we might have, but especially about our past. So it's anthropological genetics. And this is a fascinating field, and it's developing so rapidly. There's so many great papers that's being published on this with, you know, new DNA analysis on individuals that's, you know, hundreds or even thousands of years old. And it's rewriting history. And I'm not entirely sure that even historians are aware of just how rapidly the field is changing. And of course, you know, combine that with, you know, more advanced computers and new techniques, it just feels like a revolution that we're not aware of. And of course, you know, my own field, economic history, can benefit from this a lot, right? Even if we don't, you know, perfectly interested who individuals were or care about so much about the identity, but even things about pastoralism and the spread of disease and these kind of things certainly affects the way we think about the past and the economic past. So I've learned a lot over the last 2 days in fields that I would probably never have thought that I would be interested in.
Yeah, I love actually that you, like, on the one hand, give an example of development economics in Greece, and then on the other end you touch on genetics, and it kind of illustrates like how diverse economics can be as a discipline, how diversity can be applied. So I think it tends to be a discipline that can feel very removed from the real context, but that's not true at all. You just need to be able to connect a lot of different dots to show how the discipline works in the field.
Yeah, certainly, I think economics that students in South Africa are exposed to at school is very much about, you know, what we would think of as kind of monetary economics or money, right? That's how they tend to think about it. But of course, you know, it's a science that studies decision making, and so, you know, we make decisions in various respects and are influenced by all kinds of things, demography, the environment. So it touches on so many different aspects of societies.
Yeah. As the last part of my intro questions before we dive into what you've done over the past couple of years, I'd like to ask you, as someone who's probably quite educated on the economic situation of South Africa, but also the African continent, what is a thought about Africa that people who might be from a European realm like me, myself, that they really need to leave behind?
Yeah, I think Africa is far more diverse than most people think, in many, again, along many different dimensions. So, you know, just economics, the country, the continent in the world with the most variation in income per capita is the African continent. I think most people think of Africa is very homogenous and everyone's poor, perhaps. That's simply not true. So you've got, you know, high levels of intra-country inequality, but also inter-country inequality. And so that's, you know, if we ascribe certain historical, ecological reasons for why Africa's economies are relatively poor compared to the rest of the world, then, you know, that doesn't often hold up because a lot of these factors are cross-continental, whereas there's a lot of variation in incomes. So I think that's the one, that's the kind of most obvious thing. You know, I would, I've got many examples of traveling, you know, across the world, but one very particular incident that I remember is on a train in Belgium and sitting next to someone who, after a while, we started speaking and I mentioned I'm from South Africa and she's like, oh, yes, I know someone from North Africa. And, you know, and almost everyone that I know that has traveled has a story like that, right? And so you, I think the general sentiment towards Africa is a continent that is, you know, people know each other from, you know, with thousands of miles separating them, but of a homogenous continent, of a continent with little else but a story of poverty, and that's just untrue.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point to make, and a point that I had to, or that I was constantly reminded of during my time in Africa. I mean, I recently now returned to Germany, unfortunately, but very, very good point. I would probably say, okay, on the one hand, you're a professor, on the other hand, you're an author. And before we talk about your work as an author, I want to briefly touch on your work as a professor. And sure. When I visited, during my preparation, when I visited your website, it kind of leads you with a statement that if you, or like that your biggest wish basically is that you will be cited in a Nobel Prize winning work, and ideally by one of your students. So I'd like to ask you a very difficult question. So in what fields, or like what, if you had to make like a guess, what kind of ideas are currently worthy of winning a Nobel Prize?
Oof, yeah, that is a difficult question. I mean, I always get back to thinking about, you know, what are the core questions that economics ask? And especially if you think about economic history, it's like, you know, why are some countries rich and others poor, or why are some people rich and others poor? So what is it that you know, economists can contribute to adding to that question that we don't yet know? And so the one field where, you know, we are still, I mean, there's of course, you know, methods have recently, you know, been given some prominence. So the identification revolution and these things help us understand causality, which is of course incredibly important. If we want to attribute something to contributing towards something else, then understanding whether that is in fact a causal relationship is important. But I also think that there are parts of economics that are far more difficult and perhaps impossible to attribute causally. And economists think about a kind of monocausal things usually because we want to prove it. But, you know, the world is far more complex than that. And we probably have neglected things that are important, but are far more difficult to prove. What those things are, you know, there are people working on beliefs, values, trust, these things that are slightly fuzzy, more difficult to measure, but potentially incredibly important. So I can imagine that might be a future. If there is some like innovation, either in measurement or in modeling or theory, perhaps that would help us understand how these factors contribute to economic development. And again, perhaps there are also interdisciplinary areas where innovations in one discipline, like, you know, genetics, for example, and genetic analysis might help us to think about the epigenetics of certain things. So in which circumstances do, you know, innate abilities matter, or these kinds of things? I can imagine that would be a frontier field also. Complicated, of course, not to say that it's, you know, it's uncomplicated, but that would be something that I think would be important. And one thing that I tend to think a lot about is, you know, something along the lines of how is wealth transmitted across generations. So you create wealth. What are the, you know, this is not at the individual or the household level. How is wealth created, but also how is it transmitted, and to what extent do things like, you know, education or, you know, health or inheritance or, you know, whatever else might matter. explain the success or the ability to kind of be upwardly mobile or maybe even downwardly mobile. Like, what is it that causes wealth destruction would be an interesting question as well. So I think those are the areas, but they're very broad, and of course, you know, there are also many people thinking about them. But it is a little slightly kind of tongue-in-cheek kind of remark, right? But partly it would be an incredible thing to have students. I mean, I think that's really one of the amazing things about being at a university is to see students come through the system and you know, make a contribution in a way that, you know, that you yourself wouldn't have been able to do, right? Come to new understandings of the world that is novel and you know, takes the field forward. So that would be incredible.
Yeah. Do you sometimes have like students whom you deem very talented and then you try to push them in a certain direction and you just tell them, hey, like this research field is promising or not?
I have students where I would tell them, now we've reached a stage where I cannot add any more value to your education. So it's up to you, right? And some students arrive at that, you know, late in the PhD or in even masters, or in some cases it's very early in the process. I tell them that, you know, that's, I think now you've kind of superseded my knowledge of this area. Fortunately, now there's something like ChatGPT, so, you know, my knowledge is slightly longer longevity, but no, I mean, I wouldn't push someone. I would say, you know, I would give ideas and then, you know, it's up to the person to, I mean, part of the research process is coming up with ideas themselves, exploring ideas, you know, quitting certain ideas, which don't make sense. I would far rather have someone tell me this is a rubbish idea than trying to pursue something simply because I said so. And I think that's, you know, knowing when to stop is as important as having the perseverance to continue.
I was just going to say, like, they should probably also have a healthy portion of ignorance towards your advice to a certain degree, as in, like, being able to persevere, even though you might advise them against continuing in a certain direction.
Yeah.
I'd say we get to a bit of the meat of the podcast. And, I mean, you wrote a book that you've gotten quite a bit of attention for, Our Long Walk to Economic Freedom. And when I read it, I kind of was reminded a bit by, I don't know if you get this a lot, but I was a bit reminded by, or of the book Sapiens, which Benoit Yuval Harari, an Israeli, I think, historian, who kind of like narrates the short history of mankind, basically. And I felt there was a parallel because in your book, the central narrative is kind of going through 100,000 years of, well, economic history of mankind, but the difference is that you put Africa at the center of it, or you try to narrate it from an African point of view. And one of the central themes overall is, I feel that, you know, that you say builders of society win and not the burglars. So that you get rich through innovation overall and not through stealing. So that's like one of the key points that I took away from it, or that I also feel that other people take away. So a couple of my friends actually recommended it before I read it. So could you expand a bit on this central theme and how it, you know, how it manifests?
Yeah. Well, firstly, it's very generous of you to compare me to Harari. Of course, he sells in, you know, orders of magnitude more books than I did. But it's it's interesting that, you know, these chapters are pretty short. So they are, I think, 34, 35 in the latest version, and they are meant to kind of be very accessible, right? So I've got clickbait titles and all of these kind of things that make them kind of attractive and fun to read. And I mean, that's the mission, is to get more people to read them, right? It's not an academic, it's a textbook, it's prescribed here at the undergraduate level, but it's, the idea is actually that it should be accessible to as many people as possible. I think the key lesson is that it's not through redistribution that we gain wealth, but through innovation and creation of new prosperity. And I mean, there's, you know, I can put numbers behind that. We are just a far more affluent people than we were 200 years ago. I think on average 18 times more affluent, and we are 8 times more abundant. So, you know, we were 1 billion people 200 years ago. Now we're 8 billion people, and on average 18 times wealthier. So it's simply impossible that you can redistribute that from somewhere else and still have that growth in wealth. And it's, of course, not only, you know, we talk about income and wealth, but it's also living standards, it's, you know, life duration, it's infant mortality, massive declines in infant mortality. And you might even push it as far as to say, you know, we're more morally good people. So, you know, there's many different dimensions to the kind of, you know, what I think Deirdre McCloskey calls it, the great enrichment, right? We've become just a far more flourishing society. And so the book is, you know, there are, of course, books saying that already. So this is not novel. This shouldn't be new to anyone that's kind of familiar with this literature. But I try then to understand, you know, why is that? And then I try and understand or investigate the why through different episodes in history with a focus on South Africa and Africa. But it kind of boils down, if you know, to kind of give the book away, I guess, is to say we are builders because we've learned kind of two very important lessons, and that is that we should use our knowledge of nature or science, you might call that, to make ourselves more productive. And then the second lesson is that we should use that productivity, so the surpluses that we create with that productivity, to distribute that to kind of everyone, or everyone should have access to that, rather than a small, you know, political elite, which was kind of typically the case. And so, of course, these lessons have been learned over the last two or three centuries. It's not something, and you know, at different times, at different places. South Africa might have learned the first lesson already 100 years or so ago. But the second lesson we basically only learned in the last three decades. So, and so it's not that we've always known this as a society, and it's not always that we've applied these lessons. But I think, you know, over time we do see, as economic freedoms expand, we see kind of the flourishing that we would expect to occur.
Yeah. During the research for your book, I wonder, like, was this something that, like, really surprised you? What was new for you? I mean, I guess, like, you didn't know everything before writing the book. So I'm intrigued, you know, where did you stumble, or where were you, like, you know, positively surprised by something?
So the book came about because of COVID. And so this was a course that I've been teaching for about a decade at Stellenbosch before. And then COVID came, and obviously we couldn't have in-person classes. And so I started writing these chapters, and then the students came back and said, you know, they've really enjoyed the chapters, but actually their father or their brother or sister also enjoyed the chapters. So and then I thought, well, maybe this is, you know, should be accessible to a much wider audience than just the students. So some of these ideas had, you know, been developing for several years. I guess one aha moment was that many of the things, well, not many, but some of the things that I had taught and thought was true turned out not to be true. So that was also a good...
Such as?
I can't really remember. There were one or two stories that I'd always told in class. I forced myself to really to forget them now. But you know, that I thought was, you know, they were nice anecdotes. But when I actually went to search for the evidence of these anecdotes, I realized that, you know, they don't exist. So they might be still true, but you can't put them in a book, right? If you can't back it up. But I guess the I've also received some really valuable feedback, right? So the book first appeared in 2021 in South Africa. It was published, and then in 2022, it was published by Cambridge University Press internationally. And there's a lot of improvement. There's basically about 10,000 additional words in the Cambridge version, and that is because of, like, wonderful feedback that I did receive on the first version, where I could nuance some of the arguments. And that was to me incredibly useful. So there's, for example, quite a lot of extensions to the chapter on slavery because of the feedback of the first edition. And I think, you know, one of my good friends, German as well, Felix Meyer-Zuzalassen, he mentioned that, yeah, you mentioned a lot about this idea of builders versus burglars, but of course, for most of our history, in fact, it was often the burglars that won out. So it's only a recent, relatively recent phenomenon that it is the builders, and that's a very valid point, which, you know, in the book, maybe in the first version, was not very clear. So I've certainly learned a lot, and of course, you know, now that the book is published, it puts me in conversations with many different people, you know, like yourself. And again, there are wonderful conversations around that.
I wonder right now, as you were also talking again about, well, burgers not profiting that much anymore, only being like a recent phenomenon. What's like a key difference, you think, when we look at like economic history, but looking at it from an African point of view compared to a European point of view? I was thinking about that right now because, well, Africa has suffered a lot under or from European burglars, basically. Yeah. So to put it mildly.
So usually when you read a global economic history textbook, Africa is, you know, the final chapter. And kind of, you know, it's not overtly so, but the subtle hint is that, you know, it's unimportant or that there's not a lot of history there to be told. And so I really wanted to shift that around. So, you know, the first chapter starts in the southern tip of Africa and, you know, it's about the out of Africa migration, which is, of course, you know, the dawn of humanity, really, and the world as we know it. So I really firstly wanted to just change the emphasis. It is a good question how different economic history would be from a European versus an African perspective. I think the important thing is to firstly stress, as I did at the start, that there is much more to African economic history than you know, just one chapter or just one story. And so that was partly what I wanted to do, is to show, you know, there's chapters on East Africa and the Indian Ocean trade, there's chapters on North Africa and Islam, there's chapters on several chapters on South Africa and what happened here. So there are many Africans, right? It's not just one chapter, one story, which I think, you know, if you had to write this from, again, a European perspective, you would tend to spend a lot more time maybe on medieval times or I remember being in a conversation here in Stellenbosch actually with someone who couldn't believe, you know, I didn't include anything about ancient Rome or ancient Greece. But that was not the focus, right? I didn't want to really write about the Minoans or, you know, it's not a global history. It's a global economic history where you touch on certain aspects that provide valuable lessons even for today. So I think that's really the emphasis is to tell a kind of a diverse story of Africa and how these different, and it's a massive continent with many different stories. And of course, you know, it's only still a fraction of the history of Africa. So the entire pre-colonial period really is kind of shifted into one or two chapters, which, you know, is slightly nonsensical, but you know, that's, they are really rich histories still to be told.
Yeah, and as you say, then in these last one or two chapters in a textbook, then Africa is often portrayed as this poor continent that has always struggled, you know, where there's not a lot of rich history that could be analyzed or so. And I mean, you've shown in your book that is simply not true. So I think you've done a good job in like just spinning that around. But I think one of the really good examples is that a couple of decades ago, I think like 40, 50 years ago, like a lot of African states were doing a lot better than their Asian counterparts, for example. And since then, well, Asian countries have mostly done very well for themselves. And so I'd like to know, like, could you double click on that a bit? Like, how is it possible that like a couple of decades ago, Africa was actually ahead of Asia? And what happened then? Like, why is there such a difference now?
Yeah, what happened then is a more tricky question to answer. But certainly, I mean, there's wonderful evidence by two Dutch scholars on just looking at unskilled wages in many African cities compared to Asian cities. And you're right that by the 1950s, many African cities had higher unskilled wages, male unskilled wages than Asian cities. And in fact, if you read like, you know, World Bank reports of the time, you would find that, you know, the prediction for Africa is bright. The future for Africa is very bright. And, you know, we've got natural resources. You know, you can think of, you know, a climate that is conducive to growth, right? There's sunshine, there's enough rainfall. So farming will do well. In fact, I think the 1960s had the best rainfall for the entire century. So everything, just, you know, political independence now. And in many African countries, actually, from the kind of late colonial period, there was relatively high growth, 4-5%. And with, you know, the independence, it just seemed like all the institutional arguments are also in favor of Africa to do very well. The story about Asia was no natural resources, very high fertility rates, high disease burdens in many of those places, a lot of worries about the future. And of course, we know what then happened, transpired. Many African countries did, in fact, in the early colonial, post-colonial era, did in fact see some relatively high economic growth rates. But then also we know about the kind of change in politics, moving from often kind of very fragile but democratic regimes to autocratic regimes and dictatorships, contestations over resources, military conflict, and the same kind of story occurs in several African countries. So this is not kind of unique to one country. In the chapter on kind of African independence, I talk about also the kind of economic fluctuation. So in the 1970s and 80s and 90s is kind of these three decades of very poor performance. In fact, in many countries, actually negative economic growth. And a lot of, I think, our generation, I want to say kind of your generation up until even like, you know, my parents' generation would think of Africa in that context, or those three decades is reflective of a general African experience, which it certainly is not, right? So if you just go back three decades earlier, then the story is very different. And that has shaped basically the narrative of the 90s and the 2000s. And to some extent in the 2010s, it turned it around a little bit. So, you know, in 2000, The Economist would still publish, the cover would be The Hopeless Continent. In 2010, they ask for forgiveness and say, you know, this was a clearly terrible choice because Africa's fortunes have seemingly turned around. But it feels like a lot of our perspective on Africa is shaped by those three terrible decades. And the purpose really was to say that actually, that's certainly not true. If you take a longer time frame, things look very different. And so what are the lessons that one can learn comparing Asia and Africa? That's a podcast on its own, of course.
More than just that.
Yeah, exactly. Nation plays an important role. Openness, you know, Africa turns inward with the idea of import substituting policies, industrial policies, in a continent where it's very difficult to export things, and markets are relatively small. So they are not a large local market, very similar to some extent to the Latin American experience. Asia seems to be focused very much on kind of outward-looking policies. But there are various kinds of theories of what role the state played in the various different places. And, of course, even within Asia, you find some variation. I think it's just important to note that there are, you know, big differences at the moment, and those differences seems to be shaped by what had happened in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Yeah. I would like to put a focus now then maybe on, you know, because you've illustrated the potential of Africa and so why people thought, okay, this is a continent with a bright future. I'd like to ask you, so what are the conditions or what needs to happen so that African countries can harness their potential, right? And what is maybe the role of the creators that you have mentioned, right? The people who innovate. So be it scientists or entrepreneurs, you know, like what's the role of innovation, entrepreneurship in that overall, harnessing of potential.
Yeah, I'm my personality is that of an optimist. But I do think there are several good reasons to be optimistic about the future of the continent. I think the first just a very kind of fundamental thing is demography. So Africa remains a very young continent. Many people see that as a kind of a negative thing, but in fact, you know, I think if you just again need to travel to Greece to see, you know, what the opposite looks like of a society that is very quickly growing older and population in decline and with serious fiscal concerns. Japan, another good example. So a young continent where But of course, you know, you, that's exactly what you mentioned, is that one needs to utilize that resource. So you know, obviously, education is an incredibly important factor. I'm a little bit of a bench warmer when it comes to education, because to some extent I also see that education might easily follow growth rather than the other way around. Right? So I think a lot of education economists would want to say that education is pivotal input into economic growth. But my sense is also right. We've had 2 centuries of amazing development. Often the growth comes before the education. It seems like the education follows. So, but that's not to say that education is unimportant. Obviously, I work at a university, so I must believe that fundamentally education is important. But I don't think it's pivotal. I don't think it's the only thing we need to care about. And so I do want to, you know, mention something about the changing technology. And this not only the scale of it, so the speed at which technology is increasing, and here I can refer to, you know, many different domains. So, you know, again, from advances in vaccines that address some of Africa's most serious concerns, things like malaria, things like HIV/AIDS, to, you know, even things that we just, you know, use every day now, natural language processing kind of things that allow people to communicate in ways that were not possible before, have access to information, you know, just make them generally more productive. But so it's kind of scale, the speed at which things are increasing, but also scope. So it's just a diversity of different kinds of innovations, and often innovations that are applicable for the African continent. So a lot of the kind of, you know, 20th century innovations or even 19th century innovations were not necessarily immediately applicable to Africa, but it seems like something like, you know, mobile technology is very much designed almost for a continent that is rugged, that have, you know, got vast distances, landmass. So a lot of the new technologies I sense are actually something where Africans can benefit from. And so it's incredibly difficult to imagine, right? If I knew exactly which ones would be the ones to win out, then I would be rich, you know, not be talking to you. So it's very difficult to predict which technologies would be the ones that will be successful. But technology must feature in any conversation about the future of Africa. And then you care a lot about entrepreneurship. I think there's so firstly to say that there is a rich history of African entrepreneurs. So there's, you know, wonderful books. Anthony Hopkins is a famous African economic historian who's written about, you know, he's got a new book coming out next year about Nigerian entrepreneurs in the 19th century. So there's a long history of building things in Africa. And of course, that's exactly what colonialism did, was to squash some of that, right? That squashed that entrepreneurship to extract some of those rents for the colonial superpowers. That has now dissipated. The colonial obviously links, and even the post-colonial, the autocrats have mostly been displaced and are now being, you know, so not to say that it's, you know, perfect, democracy is working perfectly, but it seems like there is more, a greater openness for entrepreneurial activity across the continent. And that's great news. That means that the next generation would have the opportunities to search for those profit-making products and services, innovate, combined with the new technologies. I mean, that just seems, and again, on a continent that has got a market, right, where there's more people to sell to, where there's more wealth that's being created. So where that will exactly happen, whether it will be Nigeria or Ghana or Kenya or Tanzania, right, you know, South Africa, hopefully to some extent as well, that's unclear. It will depend on who, you know, who basically learns those 2 lessons. So who are using their knowledge of society, knowledge of nature, their science to make people more productive, and then have the institutional or have the institutions that allow as many people to participate as possible. So the whatever country does that or region, that will be the one that thrive.
I think in the interest of time, I would actually like to, you know, apply all your knowledge that you've just, you know, shared with us and, you know, apply to some more contemporary issues. And I think there are two things that are, no matter where you are on the planet, currently, like, just, you know, everywhere in the media. And on the one hand, that's climate change. And on the other hand, that's AI. So I have a couple of questions about these two topics for you. And I think I'll start with climate change. And, you know, you've mentioned a couple of things of in terms of how or like what needs to happen for Africa to harness its potential, right? And like one of the key things I think is, you know, stability, for example, and climate change has, you know, or Africa is often portrayed or shown to probably suffer overproportionately from climate change. So I'd like to know from you maybe or ask you, what are your thoughts on the impact of climate change on African opportunity or maybe economic opportunity? And where do you see maybe also promising areas for Africa to, well, mitigate against or mitigate these impacts that climate change will have on the continent?
Yeah, expert here. So I'm going to be very, I mean, you're right, firstly, to say that Africa will be most affected, probably of any world region, partly again because of its diversity, right? So you know, some ecological areas are incredibly precarious, and so, you know, they will really suffer. Again, technology optimist would say to me, you know, there could be potentially technological solutions, or at least mitigating technologies that reduce the effects of this. I mean, even just in South Africa, we've seen, right, the eastern half of the country will get wetter and the western half will get drier, and that, you know, we've, a couple of years ago we had a drought in Cape Town, but that somehow forced certain both technological and institutional innovations that I think makes us more sustainable going forward. So sure, you know, environmental disasters would be terrible, but to some extent some of these changes, if not too dramatic, could push people into a more sustainable situation if they realize that these are actually the consequences that might. And of course, you know, you need an institutional capacity to react to those changes. So, you know, that might not be true everywhere. But I do sense that, you know, that there is at least an ability or an openness to, or capacity, I guess, to react to, you know, to some of these changes that will occur, informed by science, using kind of science as well to respond to that. So that's, yeah, the environmental, the kind of climate shocks, I think are likely to affect the continent, but I think in the short run, there are far more immediate concerns for most Africans. And so I think that's, you know, if you speak to most South Africans that live below the poverty line, climate would be very low on their agenda. Of course, you know, disasters will, of course, then lift that up. But I think there are also many other concerns that we need to first address, things about, you know, safety in South Africa, perhaps, things about exactly these, you know, entrepreneurial opportunities, job opportunities for people. It's really only, you know, affluent societies, I think, where climate change will become important on the political agenda early enough so that it can be addressed. And so that I think is worth mentioning.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely worth mentioning, as you say. And I think, you know, having traveled Africa now for a bit and having talked to some people who are innovating on the continent, I like one of my biggest thoughts is usually that whenever I talk to someone about degrowth, for example, in Europe, that it's an idea that it seems to be so removed from reality as soon as you go to the context of a developing country overall. And like, I look at climate change in combination with the context of Africa, and I see that, you know, growth is like the only way that a lot of that, you know, the continent can deal with climate change overall, but that it's also like such a massive opportunity in terms of that climate change only made certain business models in Africa possible, for example. So I've been talking to this entrepreneur who started a carbon removal or a direct air capture company in Kenya. And, you know, direct air capture as a carbon removal has only become an economic opportunity because of carbon pricing, basically, or because it has become an economic necessity to remove carbon from the air. Yeah. So all of a sudden people will pay him for that, and he can do it a lot more cheaply in Kenya than in Europe, for example. So a lot of things that we need to do to mitigate climate change on a global basis are a lot cheaper in Africa compared to the West or the East, for example. So the global South, I think, has like a massive opportunity at its hands. If you just, you know, how to figure out like, and figure out like, where is your economic advantage, basically? Like, what is it that I can do more cheaply here than in Europe? And how do I get Europeans or US Americans or, you know, Asians to pay me for that, basically? But it's a, I think it's a great opportunity for economic cooperation as well between all the different continents and states, basically, to transfer some wealth to Africa and then ultimately thereby also empower, you know, those states and like give them a certain sense of like independence again and empower them to like, you know, build their own, well, more self-reliant economies overall. So that has been like one.
Added to that, I mean, two observations. I think the one is that often, I like the word opportunity in this sense, because often, right, we've, you know, South Africa is a great example of a utility that has failed miserably. And then, so our power utility, I mean, you would know this, Eskom is basically not producing enough power. But the response at the household and firm level has been actually remarkably swift, even though, you know, on a daily basis, we experience these kind of what is, you know, called as load shedding. But what you also observe over 2 or 3 years is just a rapid increase in solar panels that has been used, which, of course, you know, is done to mitigate the effects of load shedding. But the ultimate, we would never have had such rapid take up if it wasn't for the load shedding. And to some extent, you know, I guess if you take a step or two back, you know, the ultimate gain for society in South Africa, but also globally, is that you know, now South Africa has switched far quicker to remove renewables than we would have otherwise. So I think the other thing is to say that, I mean, you mentioned the state, and I think it's important to keep in mind that often these contracts, these carbon contracts, should in fact be signed, as you mentioned, with entrepreneurs rather than with the state, right? So again, If it's done with the state, it gives rise to all kinds of, you know, rent-seeking activities which you want to avoid. Whereas if it's done with entrepreneurs, there's an incentive, you know, to do it well, to be efficient, to compete, and so that's I think kind of pivotal. You know, I'm always a little bit worried when it's kind of, you know, at a national or, you know, basis that these decisions are made. Whereas in fact it should be, you know, entrepreneurs that, you know, buy and sell these carbon credits.
I'm a bit looking at the time, and we have a couple of minutes left. But nonetheless, I have a rather big question for you. So I'd like just, you know, close the big topic of climate change here and open up another big topic, and namely the topic of AI. And I mean, and I've seen that you've written a bit about AI and its potential, and that you're also playing around with some AI tools like Midjourney for, like, you know, artificially generated pictures, for example, on your blog. And so I guess that you have an opinion on the topic, at least. And you've written about a study that was conducted at MIT where two researchers gave, you know, office workers, basically, you had a university education, access to the tool ChatGPT and let them perform various tasks. And it turned out that ChatGPT really managed to make people a lot more productive, but it was apparently more effective for the people who were formerly the slower people or lower performing people, you could say. So it closes this gap between like lower performing and high performing people. And, you know, it seems that AI really has reached or broken through a certain threshold where it can really make people a lot more productive. And so I wonder a bit, like, what are your thoughts on what should people in an age of AI do to stay relevant? You know, like from an economic perspective, you know, what activities, what human activities will add more value and that one should focus on than what AI can do?
I'm blown away by the just, you know, ChatGPT and the kind of technologies around it. It's, and I spoke this morning to a colleague, and it's just remarkable. You know, the kinds of the variety of different tasks that you can use it for is crazy. And again, the speed. So it's both again, the, you know, the scope, different kinds of things, and the scale, the kind of speed at which these things are improving is. I've written about this, and I don't think people believe me. I was recently on a panel with, you know, about 30 people in the audience, and, you know, almost none of them had used ChatGPT. Those that did, that, you know, played around with it to write like some kind of poem or something funny, right? But it's basically, I've incorporated in almost every task that I do now. I use ChatGPT for that, from writing to, you know, basic menial things like creating tables, to, you know, I don't know. So it's a remarkable tool, and you're right, that study, I mean, points to the fact that you can write in, you know, basic SMS language and get a great response back from ChatGPT. So it understands what you mean, even if you're a terrible writer, which suggests to me again that, you know, people, you don't need a university degree to use it. You can use it at a very low level of education and still benefit immensely from it. So of course, accessibility is an issue, whether you can get it on your phone or it must be probably a smartphone, and there needs to be, you know, South Africa's very expensive data costs. So all of these things said, you know, in 2 or 3 years' time, I can imagine that this would be a tool that's accessible. It's like Google search, basically. Everyone's got access to it, but it's just a far, far more powerful tool. So that's one, you know, technology. Of course, there are many, 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 many others related to this. I also share a little bit of the fear of what this might do, right? So, you know, how does it look in 2 years? If this is a speed of technological improvement, you know, in 2 years' time, clearly these things, I mean, to give you a very, very kind of interesting example is this morning I wrote something where I had asked it to summarize, it was about the genetics, as I've mentioned, and I asked it to summarize a paper, but, you know, saying the prompt was something about summarize this paper, but then comment on its application to history. And it summarized it wonderfully, and then it said, as an economic historian, I did. And then I realized, but it now knows that I'm an economic historian, because I never mentioned economic history in the prompt, but it clearly knew, you know, what I do. So that's a little bit, you know, you worry a little bit about where that might be in 2 or 3 years' time. But, you know, I hope that if you treat it well, it will be complementary rather than a competitive force. And that's, I mean, I think that's been true almost of all technologies, that it's, that's not entirely true, not of all technologies, but kind of, you know, the transformational technologies have, where there's been a lot of fear about job destruction and these kind of things, it's often turned out that it's far more complementary than substituting. So, you know, let's hope for the best.
Yeah, exactly. But I can hear that you would say, okay, like, start playing around with it and don't be ignorant of it. If you want to stay relevant, basically, like, make sure that you understand what kind of tech, how you can harness it for yourself.
Yeah, just try it out. I mean, that was the key message that I also had in the panel is, you know, just try it and you'll very quickly realize, it's, you know, it's not just a toy. It can actually be used very productively and you'll also quickly realize, you know, what it's really good for and you know, what you probably should still do yourself.
Yeah, awesome. Coming to an end, my last question for you actually is based on the assumption that I assume that, well, when you, like, you know, give your last lecture to your students before they finish their degree or whatever, you know, that you have some sort of advice or some sort of inspirational ending. So I just ask you, how are you usually, you know, closing your lectures with what kind of advice, what kind of, you know, how do you let your students go into the world?
That might not be a nice story for Germans to hear, but more nicer for Spanish audience. So I end with the story on the World Cup, 2010 World Cup, where I say basically, you know, just before the World Cup, there was this professor who gave a talk, who sadly, his name I can't remember, but he gave a talk and he asked, how do you win the World Cup? Do you appoint a very expensive coach? And that's exactly what South Africa, of course, had done. We appointed Carlos Pereira, who was a Brazilian, for a crazy amount of money in 2007. And then he quit. And then we appointed him, I think, 6 months before the tournament. And of course, you know, we won one game. We lost. We beat actually France. We lost badly against Uruguay, which cost us. We drew against Mexico. So we didn't do too badly, but we didn't qualify for the next round. Or this professor asked, do you give every kid in South Africa a soccer ball? So, you know, you won't win the World Cup in 2010. You won't win the World Cup in 2014 or not even in 2018. But by 2022, which, you know, was last year, so now the story is quite kind of relevant, you would actually have a chance. You would have every kid playing and you would have, you know, the best of them would play for South African leagues and the best of them would play for European leagues. And ultimately, you would have 11 players that are world class. And so you've got a chance. And so that's basically the story of economic freedom, right? So what is the economic soccer ball that we need to give kids to, maybe not in the immediate future, but in the kind of medium to long term, they would have a chance that would empower them with the kind of tools to, you know, make a success of their lives, to kind of build a flourishing society. And so that's really what we need to think about. And it's not about some kind of top-down, you know, wonderful economic plan that, you know, a minister or a command council in South Africa or whatever decides. It's ultimately about empowering people.
Empowering people. Very good words to close with. Johan, thank you so much for taking the time. I enjoyed this a lot. All the best and have a great day.
Thanks, Pascal.